Welcome to the Vault Podcast, classic music reviews, presented by IV Creative. Now, here's your hosts, B. Cox and the crew.
Greetings and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of the Vault Podcast, classic music reviews, presented by IV Creative. It's a perspective of the classics from a fresh point of view. We appreciate you for taking your time and lending your ears to our perspective. You could be anywhere listening to anything, but you're right here with us, so we thank you. With you today is yours truly, B. Cox, and yes, I'm back. Ladies and gentlemen, I am back. I know it has been a long time since the end of season number 6, and it's been a long, long, long journey, and also a very long break, but we're back once again, and I want to thank you all for being very patient with me and the team for the Vault Classic Music Reviews for being absent for quite some time. But for those of you all who've looked on my IG profile, it's at It's Lesson on IG, and also on my Facebook page. For those of y'all who follow me on Facebook, you know I just completed a journey, and I'm very happy that journey is over with. I had to be very discreet about it, obviously, but you know, proud to say that I've completed that journey and I've reached the end of that and proud of my accomplishment. So thank you all for bearing with us, and we're so sorry to keep you waiting for so long, but we are back in the saddle to help get season 7 kicked off. Now, had to adjust some things with the schedule over the next few weeks heading into the Christmas break, which we will be taking. Your boy will be taking a vacation and we'll be gone for about 3 weeks or so. But we're going to make sure that we have you packed to the gills with content and information until that time. So we're going to be playing a little bit of catch up over these next couple of weeks, and we're going to make sure that we get you all the content and reviews and also look backs at some of these albums that we wanted to celebrate this year that we could not do during our break. But shout out to all the fans and listeners out there stateside and worldwide, despite the fact that we did not do any content over the last several months and we had to push back the premiere of season 7 for quite some time. You guys have been pushing the numbers up, and the numbers have been very steady considering the fact that we haven't put out any content. So shout out to y'all for continuing to support the show. A reminder, make sure you're going to vaultclassicpod.com, and you all have been doing that in our absence, so continue to go there. Of course, you know, we are right in the swing of late fall, going to be heading into winter soon. Make sure you're going to vaultclassicpod.com. And as you're always checking out our catalog, we want to make sure that you are going to the merch store, picking up those hoodies, those sweaters, now that the weather's getting a little bit colder, depending on where you are, and getting that merchandise to rock with for us, and also show your support for the show to make sure that we're here to keeping the vault open for many years to come. Once again, that's vaultclassicpod.com. Go check out the past shows. And of course, you can get to all of our social media pages from that website. As we always say here on The Vault, our motto is hashtag open the vault, hashtag nothing but the classics of MBTC. And we're going to kick off season 7 doing something a little bit out of the ordinary. Because we've been gone for so long, we do need to catch up a little bit on some of these milestones that we've missed. And we're going to do a little bit of a mass recap. And it's going to be of albums that we have already reviewed here in the vault. So it's going to be a little bit of a mini recap where we're going to take 4 albums that we've reviewed in our first season of the vault, and now we're 5 years later, and to see if any of the perspectives have changed, and talk a little bit about how those albums have shaped us and how they've also shaped the audience and hip hop culture all around. And so the 4 albums we'll be covering today, 2 albums that are turning 30 this year, who have already turned 30, is going to be none other than the debut studio album of the Notorious B.I.G., Ready to Die, the classic Ready to Die, 1994's classic album by none other than Scarface, Brad Jordan, The Diary, and 2 albums turning 25 years old this year, both from Raucous Records, both personal favorites of mine. The first one, Black on Both Sides by then known as Mos Def, now known as Yasin Bey, and Internal Affairs by Pharoah Monch, both were being released in October of 1999 and have turned 25 years old this year. So lots of things to cover this episode of The Vault. We're going to be taking a look back at those 4 albums, Ready to Die, The Diary, Black on Both Sides, and Internal Affairs. Now, by and large, in the first season of The Vault, we gave all these albums classic ratings, and nothing has changed about that. But I do want to go and give a little bit of perspective on each of these albums and what I've personally learned about them, and also if my perspective has changed a little bit. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of a spoiler alert. It hasn't changed for the negative at all, but if anything, my revere for these albums in those 5 years have changed for the better, if that's actually even possible, considering how much I revere all 4 of these albums. But We're going to go through each one of these albums one by one and just give our short perspective on this album. We've talked about the tracks already. You know what a lot of our favorite ones are, but we'll go over those briefly. And we'll also talk about in those 5 years how I think the legacy has changed for these albums during that time. So the first one, it's only right that we started off with Ready to Die, the debut studio album by the Notorious B.I.G., the late Notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls, Frank White, all the nicknames you could think about for this legendary MC who lost his life way too soon. So much of the talk of Biggie over these last few years has been the mystery surrounding his death, the conspiracy theories, the viable theories around his death. And also, of course, as we all know, over this summer and this past year, his former manager and also label owner partner, Sean Diddy Combs, and what has happened to him in the news with his sexual assault charges and human trafficking charges. And now that whole house of cards is starting to tumble down now 25, almost close to 30 years after his death, which is something very interesting to say the least. But with Biggie's Ready to Die, obviously has something that one of the, I would say, ground shifting albums in the hip hop genre, especially in this time period of 1994. We've talked about it lots of times on this podcast where the East Coast was starting a little bit of a revival. Now, I don't want to say that the East Coast ever really fell off, and I think most people get that confused when we talk about that time period between 1991 to 1994, as though in the early 90s, the West Coast began its ascent and commercially began to dominate. At this time, the East Coast hadn't fallen off. There wasn't a period of time where you looked at the East Coast hip-hop acts from New York and, you know, in the Northeast and say, oh, well, they were just putting out bad content. It's just that the commercial focus was on the West Coast artists and their popularity was starting to soar. And at that point, they were battling for supremacy on the airwaves, on the video channels, on the countdowns with those West Coast artists. And it really was commercially something where the West Coast was becoming a lot more popular because they were beginning to emerge as a force in the hip hop scene. Well, right around 1993 is when a shift began to happen where the East Coast began to assert its dominance once again and really began to step up that competitive level. This is where things really got competitive between the East and the West during that time. And it was because of releases starting in 1993 with Enter the Wu-Tang 36 Chambers, with Midnight Marauders, with Enter the Stage. When you also had in the next year, over 1994, you had the release of Illmatic. You had OC's Word Life. You had Redman's There Is a Dark Side. And then one of those albums included in that list would have to be this album, Ready to Die, which was Biggie's debut album. And after he had made such a ruckus of being included in Unsigned Hype with The Source, then eventually coming out with Party and Bullshit, being featured on What's the 411 remix, being on the Dolly My Baby remix with Supercat, all the mixtape stuff he did with Mr. C, and then dropping this debut album right in the midst of this competitive nature of 1994. And this being the first album really that Bad Boy dropped that became a major, major label release. When this album came out, obviously it was something that we had never heard before in regards to this raw perspective from, you know, Biggie having grown up in Brooklyn, his hard life, the fact that it was him and his mom, his dad left his mother. He did engage in a life of crime. He hustled. He went to jail. He came home from jail, almost had to go to jail again, met the opportunity to be able to meet with Biggie after being on tapes with Mr. C and freestyling and being a part of the underground culture. And then meeting Diddy and having the opportunity to be signed to Bad Boy and really basically change his life and the legacy of his family forever as a result of what happened in those chain of events. When Ready to Die dropped, Biggie was not the typical superstar that you would see, obviously, with hip hop. I mean, you saw in the movie Notorious when they said he's smooth, like he said, oh, is he like, you know, LL Cool J? He's like, nah, he's a little bit bigger. What about like Heavy D? He's like, nah, he's not that light. So he was big, as he says in the line, black and ugly as ever. And but it didn't matter because Biggie had a cachet about him and a smoothness to him, along with the street and rugged stuff that you saw on Ready to Die. That really was a perfect blended combination of the things that you wanted out of a rap star. He had the street sensibilities and the way his hardcore lyrics on songs like Give Me the Loot and Things Done Change and Machine Gun Funk and The What, that made every street dude really appreciate what it was that he was putting out there. But then he also had things like Big Papa and On One More Chance, the remix, and of course whatever was also on the album, where he could definitely get the ladies behind him as well. And it kind of showed us, man, if you have game and a smoothness in your delivery, that's all that really is what matters 75% of the time. And so that was the really big thing about Biggie, is that he was not the prototypical superstar where he either had cachet with the guys or with the ladies. He kind of fit a mold that kind of fitted with both. And so many of us that listened to this album was like, wow, skillfully being able to pull this off. And not even talking about the production on here, how it was so masterfully done. Did he kind of overseeing the projects and having the Blues Brothers, DJ Premier, Easy Mo B, Lord Finesse, Chucky Thompson, Tone and Polk, all taking a part of this production masterpiece of this album. And when this album came out, it was a tape that I received listening to this and like rewinding the tape over and over again to go back to some of my favorite tracks and listening to the what, like with Method Man, that ended side A, you know, which was the perfect way to end side A, and then having Juicy, which was the biggest single out of this album and probably will be one of the biggest two or three singles that Biggie will have ever put out, which is now a hip hop classic. And going through that and songs like, you know, Me and My Bitch, Everyday Struggle, Respect, even though some people may not necessarily like Respect like that, even though folks will clown a song like Friend of Mine, was really cleverly done. Unbelievable by DJ Premier. And then the ending this album on a track like Suicidal Thoughts, which is so incredibly dark when you're talking about ending your own life. And you can sort of hear Biggie going through this conflict in his head as he's going through this scenario where he ends his life on the phone with his friend trying to convince him not to do it. It really was gripping and like cinematic type stuff. Like, honestly, cinematic type stuff. When you're done with the album, you're kind of walking away like, man, this is really, you're talking about as far as like storyboarding, and we talked about this in my endeavor that I just went through. We talked about making a story and storyboarding. Does the story make sense? Does it lead up to something where the viewer or the listener is going to be intrigued to follow through all the way to the end? And that's exactly what I thought what happened in Ready to Die, is that the theme about it was sort of this middle fingers up to the world. I'm going for it all, balls to the wall. I'm doing this and I'm ready to die while I'm doing it. But what you're really getting is an autobiographical tale from Biggie about what his life was like and what life was like for people like him in the hood. Biggie's mom said this in the documentary Biggie and Tupac, done by Nick Broomfield, when she was talking about Biggie. She said, my son was a poet and he was a storyteller. She said, this may not be necessarily what I always went through, but this is what my reality was for me and people like me who grew up. And when we talk about bringing up a window to society, which hip hop does very well, this was an album that did it almost as well as any other album that came out during that time period, if not of all time in hip hop. And afterwards, as the time went on, and when Biggie passed 3 years after this album, not even 3 years after the album came out, and as his legend began to grow and the mythology around a person as they've lost their life as Biggie has and the greatness that surrounds them and the potential that surrounded them, an album like this grows in its legend. And what has happened since then is that we've had so many different things come out about this album. Articles have been written. Documentaries have been done. There was the documentary that they did about Ready to Die, about the albums that shook up America. And we talk about how, like, we heard from the, you know, Easy Mo B's who worked on this album, and the Chucky Thompsons, who rest in peace, who worked on this album. The words that you heard from folks like rest in peace as well to DJ Clark Kent, DJ Premier, from Lord Finesse. All these folks who were sort of involved on the fringe as this album was coming out. And they tell you about how the reaction to was it then. And then afterwards, we're talking about 20, 25 and 30 years later, people are really looking back and said, yo, what was done here was actually rare. Like what happened on this album with Biggie. And so what we have now is an all-time hip hop great that even since the last time we reviewed this album in 2019, me and the crew, it's now 6 times certified platinum by RIAA. Obviously in its standing as far as East Coast hip hop is concerned and considered to be significant in helping to bring the East Coast back. It's now ranked number 22 on the latest installment of Rolling Stone's updated list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. Not hip hop albums of all time, but all albums of all time from all genres. And is now ranked number 1 on Rolling Stone's list of 200 greatest hip hop albums of all time. Now, I know we'll get a lot of debate around that about whether or not people think that's true, but just to go to show you. And then ultimately, what has now happened as of this year is that the album was selected in the famed National Recording Registry, which is done by the Library of Congress, for being culturally, historically, and or aesthetically significant. Now, we've talked about a few of the albums that have had that designation by the National Recording Registry. Low End Theory has that. I believe also It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back has that as well. De La Soul's 3 Feet High and Rising. So we're in pretty rarefied categories we're talking about, that when you have a registry like the National Recording Registry through the Library of Congress that says we're saying that this is culturally significant, it means something. And the culture knew that all the time. But definitely, I mean, to have that recognize it now, 30 years afterwards, I mean, that is really something to marvel at. And then they did actually put out a 30th anniversary re-release, which was done, I believe, in August. You know, they did have a commemorative cover for it. People are still checking for this album 30 years afterwards. Just a testament to its greatness. Now, the next album that we'll cover in 1994, released, I would say, about a month after this album came out, was Scarface and The Diary, released on October 18th, 1994, runtime of 43 minutes, 13 seconds. And this was the third album by Scarface. What I like to say about The Diary is The Diary is an album that in its 30 years since it's been released is one that I will say from a wide variety of listeners from a number of different origins and locations, whether it's the West Coast, the Southwest, where Face is from, in Texas, Third Coast of Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, to the South, up to the Midwest, over to the East, is an album of Scarface's that is always mentioned within his top three of people's favorite albums by Scarface. And it's an album that has an incredible amount of appeal from a number of different audiences based on where they're from, their age, or what type of hip hop it is that they're most into. It has an incredible amount of appeal. And to me, with no disrespect to Mr. Scarface is Back and The World is Yours by Scarface's first and second solo albums, to me, this is the album what truly made Scarface an established solo artist. And it was something that truly got to separate him completely away from Ghetto Boys and establish him really as Brother Face Mob. This was the album that when we saw how incredibly deep Scarface can get, and we've known this from the first time that we did the review of The Diary, and we also talked about The Fix as well, how incredibly deep, spiritual, and philosophical that Face can get on these albums. The Diary, hence the title of the album, really was a peek inside of his mind. When you talk about like the imagery that you get in Scarface's lyrics and the emotion that you feel in his voice and the conviction in which he spits his songs, that is his unique selling proposition, along with a handful of maybe other rappers throughout history. But getting into this just absolute masterful production on here by the great duo of N.O. Joe and Mike Dean. And we saw that on display when Scarface did that now famous Tiny Desk concert, which absolutely captivated so many of us in the hip hop community and music lovers worldwide. When we heard the stories of Face Mob talk about him making I Seen a Man Die and him hearing that beat on one side of the glass, and how when he opened up his mouth and those lyrics just started to come out, that the eyes of N.O. Joe and Mike Dean on the other side of the glass just opened up. Why? Because they knew something special was happening. This is just amazing work. And when you talk about like the identity of Houston hip hop and of Face Mob, who was so ingrained in that hip hop culture of that part of the country, he is synonymous with Houston hip hop. And people will say, you talking about Southern hip hop, he is definitely one of the one, two, or three best rappers of all time in that region between the Southwest to the South. But you get into these tracks, and we talked about it in our first review, beyond just I Seen a Man Die or I've Never Seen a Man Cry, depending on what it is that you're looking at, the title of the song. But songs like The White Sheet and No Tears and songs like Hand of the Dead Body, which featured Ice Cube and Devin the Dude, the 94 version of My Playing Tricks on Me, you know, the song The Diary, Jesse James, all these songs like that really just capture the essence of Scarface as really a powerful artist, giving you a peek inside of the mind. This was like one of those albums that when you talk to so many different people, I don't think I've heard anybody ever in life that I've talked to about Scarface and The Diary that have had a bad word to say about this album. I mean, I have heard nothing but praise about this album from anyone, even people who aren't necessarily Scarface fans, because you have Scarface fans out there and he's one of those rappers as well that you have a loyal fan base. And he has a following that will follow him to the ends of the road because they believe in everything it is that he does and because of the quality of work he's done over the last however many years. He has his fans, but even those who aren't necessarily fans of him will look at this album and say, "Ooh, yeah, that diary is tough. That diary is tough. That album is tough." The folks who aren't necessarily even fans of Scarface will give their props to this album because they know just how incredibly impactful this album was. And when you talk to people, especially from Houston and those from the Southwest and those from the Third Coast, when they start naming their favorite rap albums of all time, the diary is going to be very close to the top of the list. It's going to be very, very close to the top of the list. And it's an album that hasn't been incredibly successful commercially. It is certified platinum, but it's an album that when we talk about the mythology around an artist, it's always in Scarface top two or three albums that people love and they definitely revere. And it's an album now, 30 years afterwards, that so many people that I know, especially around this area and the DC area, loves Scarface. They love Scarface. So many people still have this as their favorite album of all time. And I can't really argue with them about that, especially if they're Scarface fans. But definitely an album that is one to remember and one that should be recognized as one of the great cultural feats during that year of 1994 and in the last 30 years. Now, heading over to the next two albums, which are now 25 years old this year, two albums that are two of my personal favorites, especially from during this time, was right around the time I was beginning my senior year in high school. And considering the label and considering the acts were two albums that were stayed in my rotation because I was definitely a very big underground hip hop fan. And these two guys were two linchpins in my playlist and also in my soundtrack for that senior year because I admired them as MCs and I admired the work that they put out. But really, these two projects, above and beyond anything I ever could really expect out of them. The first one we're going to talk about is obviously Black on Both Sides by Mos Def, now known as Yasiin Bey. Released October 12th, 1999 by Raucous and Priority Records. And runtime of 71 minutes, 21 seconds. You know, production on this by, of course, Mos Def. But then the likes of Diamond D, Geology, 88 Keys, Ayatollah, Ali Shaheed Muhammad, Psycho Les. You know, so many different great producers on here. This album, when it dropped, was right off of the heels of 1998's Mos Def and Quali R, Black Star's debut album, which to me is a classic, which to me is laid the foundation for those two to really begin for the next 25 years to have, maybe if not commercially celebrated as proficient careers, but definitely efficient careers over the next 25 years. Separately and also collectively, Mos Def and Quali. They have had efficient careers over the last 25 years, and that really started from that 1998 release of Mos Def and Quali R. But Black on Both Sides, this album, and we always, man, we revered Mos Def because of his slick wordplay. His flow was impeccable. We had heard him, of course, on not just The Lyricist Lounge Volume 1, and I heard him on Sound Bombing 1 and Sound Bombing 2, which came out earlier that year. When we knew that he was getting his own solo album, we all was like, man, what is Mos going to do about this? And we got it from the first single that he came out with Miss Fat Booty, which is an incredible song, even all these years later, produced by Ayatollah. But an incredible story that talks about this girl he meets in the club, and how he falls in love with her, only to find out he knows that it can't work out because, you know, she is what she is. And it's not definitely somebody that you want. Obviously, we can say the words that we know now, she was for the streets. And for lack of a better word. But this whole album is just incredible in its depth. It's incredible in its complexity in regards to the different styles that are utilized here, rhyme-wise, musically diverse. And that's something that you can understand knowing when you know about Mos Def and knowing about, you know, the different talents that he has beyond just being an accomplished MC, but a great poet, a decent singer, be better beyond decent singer. I mean, the man played Chuck Berry in a movie, for crying out loud. You know, he definitely has his talents, man. He really put a full display of all of his creative talents on display in this album. I mean, from the very beginning, from that intro, all the way through all these different songs that you heard. We talked about Miss Fat Booty, but songs like Hip Hop, and talk about another song like Speed, like the messaging in some of these songs. I want to go there for a quick second. Messaging in songs like Speed Law, and then Got, And then Umi says, and New World Water, and Rock and Roll, and Climb, and Habitat, and then Mr. Nigga, and Mathematics. The messaging in these songs are something that, like, yo, you really have to pay attention during this album. This is not just to put on and just play in the background. You got to listen to this album and, like, like Wesley said in White Man Jump, you listen him, but do you hear him? Because you need to do both during this album, right? You really do. But the messaging in these songs, you talk about how socially conscious some rappers can be and whether what's the role in hip hop, what MCs need to be in regards to being socially conscious and politically involved. Mos Def has always been somebody that's been socially conscious, and you hear that in the messaging in those type of songs, man. We talked about this during the original review. How many of these songs proved to be prophetic? How many of them proved to be prophetic? New World Water? I mean, let's, we talk about this, and 15 years afterwards, what are we dealing with? The water crisis in Flint, and in so many different other places and communities of color, where a basic human right and fundamental right of having water that you should be able to drink is not even something that's guaranteed to us. You know, talking about being about God and understand that you have to keep your head on the swivel out here. Mathematics, which is to me one of the dopest produced songs that DJ Premier has ever done for someone outside of Gangsta or Nas, is so brilliantly done when you talk about the numbers of it. You know, that first verse ending it, this new math whoop a motherfucker's ass. You want to learn how to rhyme? You better learn how to add. I mean, it's so true today, considering the fact of where the young kids are at today now, and the fact that, you know, so many things are being oversimplified, and the messaging in a song like Mathematics, or like in Mr. Nigga with Q-Tip, man, this album was prophetic on so many different fronts. Beyond the fact that, of course, it was just expertly produced, I think the sequencing in this album is something that was amazingly done, and Mos Def had the perfect set of guest appearances in this. Everyone from Busta Rhymes to Quali, his partner Quali, Q-Tip, and Vinnie Mojica, you know, who we're still looking for Vinnie Mojica because we miss her, man. But those songs, man, these songs really was a soundtrack for like a movement and for a subset of us who clung to really that raucous roster and the type of music that they put out, that this was really like the crown jewel of that, the solo releases that Raucous put out during this time. It's something that I still love to listen to now from periodically throughout the year, to go back and just be able to remember, man, going back to that time and understanding how blown away I was from the brilliance of this album, of Mos Def and his lyrics, his flow, and then also the concept of these songs being put together. It really was something that was just amazing. And now, 25 years later, we're looking at this, and it's an album that people listen to. And when you see the posts and stuff put up on social media, the reaction from the people about this album. Again, never heard anybody say a bad thing about this album either. If you don't like this type of hip-hop, then it's not your cup of tea, then that's fine. But anybody who was willing to give this a listen and judge it on its face for what it is that they get from it has never had a bad thing to say about it. And that, to me, speaks volumes. 25 years later, to me, one of Raucous's best releases, still to me, Mos Def's best album. And it starts and is right in, actually, it's right in the middle of the trilogy that I say is the holy trilogy of Black Star. In 1998, you have Mos Def and Quali R come out. 1999, you have this, Black on Both Sides, come out. And in 2000, you have Quali and High Tech's Reflection Eternals, Train of Thought, come out in 2000. That, to me, when you talk about a three-album run, that's an unconventional three-album run, which we want to do a bonus episode about that later on in this season, about three-album runs that are unconventional. That right there is a three-album run that is as good as any during this time period. And I'll put that up against anybody if anybody ever wants to discuss that. Still have a lot of regard about for this album, and still listen to it every once in a while just to be able to go back and remember about what I felt during that time. And then the last album that we'll cover during this look back is an album that blew me away because it came out, I would say, about a week or a couple of weeks after Mos Def's Black on Both Sides dropped. And this was when Raucous was on an absolute heater when it came to them dropping albums. It actually came out exactly a week afterwards. The solo debut album of Pharoah Monch, Internal Affairs, released on October 19th, 1999. Runtime of 53 minutes and 22 seconds. Producers on this, Pharoah himself, but then also production from DJ Scratch, The Alchemist, and Diamond D, among others. So this Pharoah Monch, after being a member of Organized Confusion for the better part of the 90s, had been hearing these talks, obviously, about people wanting a solo album from him. He gets to deal with Raucous. He signs with them. And this album comes out a week after Raucous puts out one of their trademark releases and Black on Both Sides. And you would think if you have releases that close together to each other that one may steal the thunder of the other, and it was nothing like that of the sort whatsoever because they complemented each other well. And when we finally got this debut album from Pharoah, it was everything so many of us wanted and so much more as far as what we expected. Pharoah, to me, is a lyrical wizard. And to so many of us, a lyrical wizard. The things that he's able to do with words and syllables and the way that his flow is able to manipulate these words around a beat is something that very little MCs have the ability to do. Tretch has that ability to be able to manipulate words around a beat. Busta Rhymes had this ability to be able to manipulate words around a beat, depending on what kind of beat it is that he's on. When Pharoah has his opportunity to step out on his own and shine on his own on an album, he delivered. He stepped to the plate and he batted 1,000. And when you get into this album and listen to these tracks, and he put out, I think it was a 20-year commemorative release when this album turned 20, when we first started the pod 5 years ago. And the first time that the album actually was put back into print, it was out of print after a certain amount of time. When you go and you listen to these tracks on this album and hear Pharoah masterfully wizard himself through these songs lyrically, songs like Behind Closed Doors and Queens, and a song that is really provocative like Rape, the so now classic Simon Says, which which is the biggest song he has ever put out, an official Hell Even With Cannabis, the Hard Hit and No Mercy features MOP, The Truth featuring Common and Quality, which to me is probably one of my favorite one or two songs on the album, the Simon Says remix, The Light, which was produced by Diamond D. I mean, he really sort of like the same way that Mos Def sort of put out a complex album that was diverse and had depth to it. This also had depth to it as well. To me, this was probably a little bit more hard-hitting in regards to it being hardcore. That's only because that's the type of style of MC that Pharoah was. But there are no skips on this album. To me, this album is, I had one questionable track from the last review that we did, and that was The Ass, you know, track number 11. I was a little bit shaky on that one. After listening to it over these last few years, I kind of take the track for what it is. It's a humorous track, you know, and that's Pharoah again, sort of stepping out and giving the album some depth and giving it something a little bit different. And it sort of strikes me the same way that a song like The Light was. But Pharoah here does not sacrifice any of his lyrical content or quality. He definitely is on the top of his game here. The quotables on this album are absolutely crazy. They're insane and out of this world. Production on here done by DJ Scratch, done by Pharoah, by Lee Stone, by The Alchemist, by Diamond D are all ridiculous. And Alchemist was at this point when he's fresh off of producing for Murder Music by Mobb Deep, which was the very first review that this pod did. And this is when he was making his introduction really to the hip hop audience at large by becoming, which would become one of Mobb Deep's like main co-producers along with Havoc of the group over the next 4 to 5 years after Murder Music came out. But Alchemist is in the beginning of his introduction to the hip hop community. And in this period of time between the release of Murder Music to Internal Affairs, he's really put out some really quality music in regards to the realness and also with No Mercy featuring MOP. This Pharoah Monch album, something that now hip hop heads, you talk about those folks that loved Raucous and loved underground hip hop, and those especially that loved Pharoah and his work that he did with Prince Po with Organized Confusion. You know, for those who love that work by him, we love this album because we got to see Pharoah literally just full out doing a complete routine with everything laid out on the line bare, and he gave it to us raw. And so years afterwards, when we all look at this album now, we look back at it fondly because it gave us our first opportunity to have Pharoah on a stage by himself for him to show us exactly what it was that he could do. And still, to this day, looking back at this album is the start for us to see just how a skilled MC the Pharoah Monch truly was. And for those of us who love lyrics and love flow and love skilled MCs at their greatest, Pharoah is still within a class of his own in regards to how skilled he is and how he can manipulate words around the beat and manipulate the syllables within these internal rhymes that he does. So shout out to Pharoah Monch and shout out to Raucous for putting out two albums back to back. And those two albums not cannibalizing each other or hurting the effort of the other. If anything else, they were more complimentary than anything. So there's our wrap up. Our first episode back onto the vault. We wanted to go through these four albums and give you a little bit of a mini wrap up. Ready to Die, The Diary, Black on both sides, internal affairs, all turning now, 30, 30, 25, and 25 years old, respectively. What do y'all think about these albums? Hit us up in the comments on social media. Hit us up on our YouTube page. What do y'all think? What is your perspective on each one of these albums? And if out of these four, you had to pick one, what album are you listening to and why are you listening it to? And you have to do away with the other three. Which one are you picking and why? Hit us up in the comments. Let us know on social media. We love to continue the conversation. And that is going to wrap up yet another edition of The Vault. Please make sure you are visiting us at vaultclassicpod.com. That's vaultclassicpod.com. There you can learn more about the show, check out our past episodes, join our mailing list, leave a review, or if so inclined, you can leave us a voice note. Click the blue microphone in the bottom right-hand corner to leave us a voice note to let us know what you think about the show or to just show us some love. To support the show, click the coffee cup shaded in yellow in the bottom left-hand corner to access our Buy Me a Coffee page. On Buy Me a Coffee, you can give a small monetary donation to support the show to ensure that we can keep the vault open for many years to come. You can also visit us on social media at Vault Classic Pod on IG, Twitter, and on TikTok. Also hit us on YouTube and our Facebook page. Like and follow us on social media. Subscribe to the pod and the YouTube channel. We do it here all for you. We appreciate the support. And if you have a friend, tell a friend and make sure that that friend tells a friend. Always remember to keep your headphones on and your music loud, but not too loud. And as we close, we'd like to remind everyone to dream big because dreams are the basis for creation. Always create, motivate, and elevate because you were never destined or created to stay stationary or ordinary in this life. And on that note, we say peace.
Thank you for listening and coming into The Vault. Please subscribe and visit us at vaultclassicpod.com. That's vaultclassicpod.com.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for a limited time and subject to change. Max 1 offer per account.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.